Hi guys, and welcome to the GMBN podcast. This week we have a chat with Mr. Greg Callahan. He's got a lot on his plate at the moment, not only his recent announcement of his move to Unió da Vinci, but also with the EW West just on the horizon. He's got a lot going on. We chat about what Red Bull actually gives you as an athlete, how you thrash out a contract, as well as life in the fast lane with all his racing. It's a really, really cool chat and I hope you enjoy it. This is one of the first podcasts we've done audio only, and it's also done remotely. This helps us keep our finger on the pulse and give us really relevant and current stories with some of the biggest names in the business. I really hope you enjoy it, and let's take it away, Greg. Welcome to the GMBN podcast. Thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So I suppose you are kind of a hot commodity in the news stakes at the moment because you've just announced your new team moving on to da Vinci. Mm-hmm. Unió da Vinci. How did this come about? Was it a long time in the works? You know, I mean, for us as external cycling fans, we get really excited around silly season and all that entails. It'd be really cool to hear how it really works and how long ago was this plan?
Yeah, I love it as well. Even, you know, as a rider, I'm still a fan as well. And I've been keeping an eye on all the team rumour stuff all winter. This deal in particular happened quite fast, actually. It was kind of mid-season that I was starting to kind of look around. And I knew, my contract was up with Cube, so I knew, you know, maybe a change wouldn't be a bad thing. But it was a strange one because there wasn't that many seats open on teams, should I say. Like, there was... It always depends where your contract lands compared to others. Like, if there's a load of guys moving from different teams, then there's many options. But this year, there wasn't actually that many people moving, so there wasn't many free seats on teams. A lot of teams were already, you know, pretty set in their ways, or maybe weren't taking on a new rider or whatever. So it was quite enough for a while, and then pretty close to the end of the season, I got chatting to the guys from da Vinci because I'd heard that Damien was moving over to Orbea, and met up with Bass, the team manager, and straight away it was like, this feels really good. It feels like a good fit. You know, the team manager's a young guy. he still races a bit himself. Like, he's a good rider. He's pretty in tune with all the trends and what a racer needs and all those things. So, you know, straight away after just having a beer with him for an hour or whatever, I was pretty happy with what was on the table. And then it came together pretty quick after that. You know, got a bike, rode that a couple of times, and decision was made probably mid-October, I'd say, so not long after the end of the season.
Oh, cool. Because that's another thing, you know, in other sports, like sports such as, you know, your Formula Ones and your footballs, you know, real global superstars. Mm. They all have so many agents and it all goes through. And often I think sometimes the player might even just get told, oh, by the way, the money's right, so you're moving football team or something. How much, you know, when you're going through this, it must be quite a nerve-wracking experience in a way because it's contract laws are a very complicated thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's always an interesting one because, you know, we're all bike riders. We're not, you know, we don't have business degrees, marketing degrees, any of these things. So when we suddenly get dropped into these conversations about contracts and salaries and all that, we're kind of winging it. You know, you get some advice. Like, I do have an agent here who's kind of giving me some help and giving me some advice. But at the end of the day, the brands want to speak to the rider. So it's me having the conversation. Which, it's always a funny one. But I think it's, you know, it's usually pretty mutual that you want it to be a fair deal on both sides. Like, if the brand takes advantage of the rider, it's not going to be a happy rider, and that's not good for anyone. So you know, I think the way MetBiking is kind of a small industry is a good thing in that way, that it's, the conversations are pretty open and trustworthy, and you know, everyone's got each other's best interests at heart, really.
It's kind of also, I feel, and you know, my experience just working for teams is that, you know, it is such a tight-knit community that you couldn't, for instance, you couldn't run a team in an unfair way and still find it easy to recruit people because everyone knows each other, you know. And so kind of just the fact that it's so open moderates it. In terms of going from Cube, where you obviously had loads of success and really established yourself as, you know, one of kind of the best enduro riders in the world, is there an element of sort of, if it's not broke, don't fix it, or, you know, like, especially going to the equipment, it must be quite nerve-wracking. Do you get much a chance to try bikes and all the different stuff, or is it a case of you kind of have a ask around to see what the deal is?
Yeah, it's definitely a nerve-wracking decision to make, and it's something that you really have to think about. You know, in my case, the last couple of years, you know, in my eyes, weren't that successful, so I kind of felt like a change would be welcome, and that, you know, a change of environment would be something that would benefit me. And I did, the guys were really good actually in getting me a bike pretty early. So pretty much straight after Trophy of Nations, they sent me a bike. So I was able to ride that and ride my two bikes back to back. And straight away I was like, right, here's my cube that I've spent the full season setting up, getting dialed, getting comfortable on. And then I jumped straight onto the DaVinci. And the times were pretty much the same from day one. So I was like, right, okay, like, I haven't spent any time learning this bike, setting it up, and I already feel so comfortable on it. So from there, it was like, right, you know, it's at least a step better, you know. So that gave me a lot of confidence in the decision, and that was what, you know, made me finally say, like, yes, okay, like, I was pretty certain of my decision anyway, but just to ride the bike just confirmed that it was a good choice.
Because is there also, when you were competing where margins are so tight, something for, you know, somebody like me who just potters around the woods, going between different fork supplies, you know, there might be some that I maybe prefer slightly more, but a second here or there isn't going to make a difference. You know, sometimes you see teams that, you know, go from, you do hear rumours about people just not getting on with a certain brand of fork or a certain brand of, I don't know, tyre or whatever. How much do you think difference does that make? Now racing is so tight. If you were to go, although I'm pretty sure DaVinci's winning Fox, like how nervous would you be about changing something like your suspension supplier?
Yeah, it's huge. Like, as you say, now we've stayed on Fox, so the change for me wasn't huge, because the suspension, the components were pretty much the same. Like, it's frame, wheels and tires that changed, but saying that, they're massive components. Like, that's, you know, the wheels and tires are your contact to the ground, so it has such a huge effect on the feeling that the bike's going to give you. But again, straight away, you know, I was really impressed with the Max's stuff, and it felt good straight away. So it was, you know, it was a pretty easy decision to make in terms of that. But yeah, as you say, it's huge, and it's quite amazing. It's quite interesting to see, because, you know, everyone's on good bikes that we're racing with, but there's been times where, you know, you might have someone on a bike that's not that good. And even for example, me in 2017, the bike I was racing was, you know, it was marketed as an all-mountain bike. It was a 140mm 29er. But it worked so well, and it fit the races we had that year, and it fit how I was feeling at the time. And, you know, it worked out well. So it's quite interesting to see how you can have so many different types of bikes in a race, and yet the times end up so close. And, you know, the same goes for riders. You can have different riders, different approaches, and the times end up the same. It's amazing.
I think that year, 2017, was quite interesting because you had, I think at that point, Jared was still riding a Stump Jump, which is more of a trail bike. You had some of the Giant guys on the Trance, which was yet again, you know, and there was still, I still feel that Enduro is still settling down, you know, as to what actually is the kind of the best tool for the job in some ways. The last time you changed team, or you joined a team, was going from a privateer, which had actually been remarkably successful, to Cube, which is a big company, big operation. What was that like, going from out the back of your van, all on your own, to this huge, you know, setup with the resources available, probably incomparable?
It was a pretty crazy time. Like, I remembered it was coming towards the end of the season. I went to Eurobike that year, and as you say, I'd had a really good season as a privateer, and I went to Eurobike and was speaking to all these brands, and like, it had cost me a lot of money to get to Eurobike, and that was money I didn't have to spend. And up until that point, every bit of money I earned, I spent on riding and racing my bike. And then you're sitting down with these people telling them that you want money for it. Like, you want a salary.
Yeah.
And I was just like, this is surreal. Like, I almost felt a bit guilty, because like, it's not only going from not costing you money anymore to you're actually going to make a profit from it. So, it was pretty bizarre at the time. And, yeah, it was just a bit of a roller coaster for that next year. Just the amount that changed of, you know, not living in a van for races, not having to work in between races and all that stuff, to then having someone working on your bike, paying for your dinner, paying for your hotels, your flights, all that stuff. Like, it was, yeah, it was a different world to me.
So I actually, when you say that, I remember Fabien Cousine, who's the manager of Polygon, which is the team I used to work for. I met him maybe years ago and we got talking. This was long before I worked for the team. And I just said really excitedly, because I'd always wanted to work on World Cups. I just said, if you ever need anybody just to come and help, like, I'd, you know, do it for free. So it was really peculiar. A couple of years later, like, that thing that I was, you know, super eager to do for free, he was like, oh yeah, we can pay you. I was like, oh my God, you know, it's like working on a big team is such a cool thing. Because when you were a privateer, am I right in thinking that you were a cycle courier? Is there any truth in that? Is that just rumour?
I was a courier, but I wasn't a cycle courier. I was a contractor for UPS. So I was driving around in a car or a van doing deliveries. Which, to be honest, was actually good fun, because it's quite an interesting job. Like, you know, in the morning you're given your 90 packages or whatever, and you're like, right, as fast as you finish these, you're finished your day's work. So, you know, if you want, you can get it done real fast. If not, you know, we can chill out and get it done whenever you get it done.
yeah.
But it's mad looking back, because, like, I was waking up half six most days, going out on the bike, doing a session, going to work, doing my full day's work, and going to the gym afterwards. Like, I was probably doing the same volume of training then that I am doing now. And, like, if you were to drop me back into that world and tell me, like, right, do all the training you're doing, but do a work day in between your two sessions, it'd kill me. Like, it would flatten me. So it's quite amazing that your body can just be used to that and just deal with it and be okay with it. But then, in saying that, you know, once I turned professional, I didn't necessarily do anything drastically different in my training. It was just that in between I was actually recovering and chilling out and doing what I was meant to be doing. And I think that's where the improvements came from, not necessarily doing any more different training.
Because another big change, I suppose, for you, going from, you know, sometimes you see Red Bull sign very young talents, you know, teenagers. But you were already quite an established racer. You know, was it 2016 you signed for Red Bull?
It was 2017, towards just at the end of the 2017 season, yeah.
You'd already won, you know, world enduro races, EWSs. What is the, just for the outside perspective, what does Red Bull give you, aside from crates of energy drink? Because, you know, I mean, like, is it support? Is it network? Is it logistical? How would you sum it up?
It's kind of hard to sum it up in a concise way, because there's so many elements to it. Like, for example, that first off season I was with them, they sent me on a training camp with G. Atherton to California, which, you know, is beneficial in so many ways. And then on top of that, you get loads of cool opportunities to do different events and meet different people you wouldn't have. Like, I got to sit in a Formula One car. I was a judge at a Red Bull Flug Tag, which is when people build crappy airplanes and try fly them off a pier. And then, you know, there's a lot of media opportunities come with it. And there's as well that recognition you get, you know, when you wear the hat or the logo on you, it kind of has this universal recognition of, like, oh, he must be pretty good at something. Even though if they don't know what, they'll just know that maybe you're good at something. So yeah, it's really cool.
Different every time.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and on top of that, like, they, whatever you want, it's kind of there. Like, if I want help with training, they have the resources there that can help me with that, or with testing, or should I get injured, there's, you know, they have all the contacts to help with rehab and stuff, which is fantastic. Yeah, like, when I originally signed, I went to Austria for a lot of different tests. And, you know, the data that we got from that with my coach was amazing. It was really, really useful to get that kind of information.
Yeah, it's really interesting because, like you said, it is, you know, universally recognised now. And it's almost kind of, I imagine it probably, as an athlete, it ticks, that recognition probably ticks a big box. Because if you're new to a sport, like, I watch a sport that I've never, maybe motocross, I'm not that well versed in. And the guy in a Red Bull hat, I think, oh, they're probably one to watch. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's amazing. And it's amazing how they've kept it so exclusive all these years. Like, it's really incredible that, you know, with other energy drink brands, you might see the logo on someone and they could have just bought it or whatever, you know, whereas with Red Bull, like, you can't buy the stuff. It's so exclusive. And when you see the helmet or hat or whatever, you know, it means something. And you know, I still, like, whenever I take my helmet out or put it on, I'm still looking at it just like, well, that's pretty damn cool.
Yeah. Because a couple of years ago, well, 2015, you know, you kind of, for those that followed the sport, they, you know, they obviously knew you were a fantastic rider, capable of achieving, you know, the wins that you've got in you. But going into Wicklow, what was that like? For those that don't know, Wicklow, you know, home EWS round, and the Irish scene is obviously super strong and everybody was really behind you. Mm. Mentally, how did you approach that race? To come away with the win is pretty extraordinary.
Yeah, like, I'm literally getting goosebumps just hearing you say that. Just to think about it again, you know. yeah, it was great. That first year was insane because, like, I hadn't been on a podium before that. And I remember coming in, like, some people were like, ah, wouldn't it be funny if you won? Or, like, do you think maybe you can get a top five or a podium? And I was kind of like, yeah, that'd be cool. And I wasn't thinking too much about it. Like, I wasn't trying to big myself up too much. And I just remember, like, I don't actually remember much from the day, and I didn't actually take in much from the day because I just really, really drilled into myself, like, just focus on the process of today, like, just ride each stage as well as you can, do everything you can to the absolute best of your ability. And I didn't see a single time all day. It was like there was a secret rule on the hill not to tell Greg what was happening in the race. And, like, as the day went on, like, Marshall, you know, we had the feed zone, and, like, a marshal would come up and just be like, hey, going all right, is it? And, like, they were just like, everyone just knew, like, just don't say what's happening. So I knew nothing. And I finished the last stage, and my dad was just like, you were 15 seconds up before that stage. And I was just like, I just didn't believe him. I was just like, no, you're talking shit. Like, there's no way. And, like, from everyone from the outside, like, I won the last stage, and everyone from the outside was just like, you idiot. Like, you did not need to go and win that stage. But I really had no idea. Like, you could have told me I was fifth and I'd be like, yeah, cool. But yeah, to come into the finish and be told what the actual result was, I was just like, oh my God, this is insane. And even, you know, I remember coming down into the finish field, and as crazy as it was, I didn't really realise what was going on because I'd been almost ignoring it all day. So I still, like, was just dropped into the situation and I didn't really realise the scale of it. And then, yeah, it was kind of... And then even after that, we were straight into a race in Scotland the next week, so I couldn't really, you know, sit back and enjoy it too much because it was straight to focus on the next one. And then it was after that that I really realised what had happened over those couple of weeks and how incredible it was.
Yeah. Because, you know, as we watch the recap of the EWS, you know, we see it blow by blow. Oh, you know, they've gained a second here, lost a second there. How aware are you of the stage results as you're racing? And is it ever a case of, I know I'm a second down on a podium? Stories of, like, you know, Nico Vulio back in the day being like, oh, I need to go a second faster because it's world champs, and just being able to do it. Is that something that plays on your mind, or do you just blank it all out?
Yeah, no, it is. It is. Definitely. I think as, like, in 2015, you were able to ignore the results and not know about it. But I think now you can't avoid it because there's so many interviews and so many people talking to you during the day that if you're winning a race, you'll know you're winning the race. And the thing with enduro is it's like in downhill, you go into the start gate on a clean slate. You know, if it's world champs, maybe not if it's the overall, that's a different kind of thing. But, you know, you're just prepping yourself up to give it your everything. Whereas for enduro, you could be leading with one stage to go, and then you'll have an hour and a half of pedaling up the hill or whatever it may be to dwell on that and think about it. And that's when, you know, you can, your chinks in the armor can kind of show, because, yeah, you need to be mentally strong to keep yourself in the right mind frame for that. And I think a big lesson for me was Tasmania 2017. Yeah, the crazy wet day. And I finished stage six, no idea of the results, because a lot of the course that day, you didn't really see the crowds and you didn't see much of the media. So I hadn't really spoken to anyone and the internet was down and that kind of stuff. And I got to the end of stage six. I had no idea I was leading the race. And Rick McLaughlin interviewed me and he was like, what do you think of this last stage seven? It's like a minute and a half long. And I was like, oh, you couldn't win the race there, but you could definitely lose it. Didn't have a clue what I was talking about. Went up to liaison, and on the liaison, someone said to me, he's like, do you know how you're doing? And I was like, nope, and I don't want to know. And I could kind of, after leaving Rick, there was people cheering, like saying good luck and smiling at me. And I was with, like, Sam, Windmasters, Jack Moore, And I was like, why are they all saying it to me? And, the penny dropped. And someone said to me, do you want to know how you're doing? And I was like, no. And I was like, you're doing well, really, really well. And I was just like, oh, crap. And I had 10 minutes before the next stage. And because I just went from knowing nothing to knowing everything, it did crack me, to be honest. And it was a minute and a half stage, and I just watched the front in a turn. And ended up dropping to second. It was my race to lose, and I did lose it. And yeah, of course, I said that to Rick as well.
Imagine if, in a strange twist of fate, that person that told you was listening to this podcast and goes, oh my God, got Greg an EWS win.
I haven't said it directly, but he kind of knows. We all know him. I'm not naming names.
Because in 2017 was actually a really cool year, because you had that nothing short of heartbreak with Tasmania, but then winning in Madeira. Previously, your wins had been at home in Ireland, both of them.
Mm-hmm.
How was that? Not only, after the trauma of Tasmania, but to kind of establish yourself saying, I'm more than just somebody that wins at my home races. I can do it on foreign lands. Did that mean a lot to you?
Yeah, absolutely. That was a huge thing. After winning Ireland twice, I was like, I don't want to just be that guy that wins at home. And it was really it was bugging me a bit. I really wanted to prove to everyone that I could win anywhere, and Tasmania felt like a real missed chance of that. And as I say, Tasmania was a huge lesson. So in Madeira, then I kind of followed the results the whole weekend. And I think it was two or three stages to go, I took over the lead, and I knew. And I remember Jared coming up to me and was like, have you seen the results? And I was like, yeah, I know what's going on. He was like, right, you know what to do. There's nothing I can tell you. You know what to do. And I think it was 2 seconds or something between me and Martin. And I was just I just remember being in the start gate, look, I'll only regret if I go too slow and lose this. So I just went full YOLO, full world champs race run for that last stage. And managed to get the win. And honestly, I think because I followed the whole race and I knew the results the whole way, and it was a 2-day race, so it was a bit drawn out, I feel like that was the most, kind of the win that felt the best in a strange way, just because it was it felt like such a tense race, and it was a pretty massive race as well. I think it was one of the biggest we've ever had. And to be in a battle like that, know I was in a battle like that, and then come out on top, it was pretty damn cool.
Because 2017 was a strange year. It was dubbed Enduro Wet Series.
Yeah, it was.
Being a lad from Ireland, that was probably right up your street.
Yeah.
How, and EWSs have changed so much over the years. I think in 2018, it was a case of everything was just super, well, obviously it's always gnarly, but it seemed the courses were really, really technical.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a year that you think, looking back, having raced it, quite a long time now, that you think, oh, that was vintage EWS. That's what it means to me. And all the others have been a slightly different interpretation, but it was 2015 where, bam, that was what Enduro is.
Yeah, it's definitely every year seems to have its own kind of character to it. It's still such a young sport, and it's still finding its feet, so people are trying to find, where's the limit. Maybe they'll go to the limit and then bring it back, and then we went back too far, bring it up again. And it hasn't really found that happy medium, and maybe there's not a happy medium, because the beauty of Enduro is that it's so diverse. So say the first two races this year, the first one is Colombia, which stages are between 3 and 6 minutes long, and then the next week we'll go to Chile, where there's 25 minute stages. So, there's no, if someone asks you what Enduro is, there's no one answer of what it is. And that's pretty cool. Looking back at the early days, 2013, 2014, some of the stages we had were mental. I remember a stage in Scotland, I think it was 2014. And we probably rode a minute and a half of track in the Golfy, turned onto a fire road, did a minute and a half of an uphill, and then dropped into another minute of track. And it was just no one really knew any difference. It was oh, okay, we're going to have to do that. Whereas now, if that stage was in it, there'd be uproar and it'd probably get cancelled. And I think things like that are really cool because, pedaling is part of it. It's a bicycle race, so there's no problem with that. Even the likes of Valdalos, I think we did 10,000 metres descending and over the course of the race, which...
Jesus Christ.
There's been some insane races over the years, and when you look back, like, it's so cool to just see all the different places and styles of race that we've had, and it's yeah, it's pretty cool to be a part of it.
So when you're racing, you know, that amount, you know, huge accumulative vertical descended per day, especially under race conditions, injuries are inevitable. I once heard you say something in regarding the injury you've had in this last year with your foot, about how so many, you know, the rider comes back racing and people think, oh, they're back now. But actually, that's just getting back on the start line. It's often just one part of the process, but the healing will still continue. Do you think that, well, what percentage of the field do you think are actually kind of healing at any one time, if you see what I mean?
Yeah,
because you
yeah,
do see
absolutely.
People that seem to have off races and off years, and actually they're coming back from something that can start quite simply, and it just can escalate. Like,
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
You hear people, George Brannigan's a good example that seems to have loads of issues with his collarbones.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, George's collarbone streak is insane. Hopefully, that's the end of it for him, and he can, you know, move forward from that. Yeah, it's really interesting, you know, because we spend so much time together at the races as riders, on the liaisons and waiting at the top of stages and whatever it is. So you'll always see people, you know, maybe favouring a bit of a shoulder, trying to stretch it out or whatever, because maybe they had a crash in practice or on an earlier stage or whatever. And I feel like a lot of the field have something that, you know, it's maybe some kind of an injury or a knock or just a niggle that they might have. But, you know, I think probably a lot of sports are like that, especially sports of this nature where crashing and stuff is kind of part of it. But it's quite amazing, you know, when you do get in a good flow in a stage and the adrenaline gets up, how you can just, you can forget about so many things and just block it out. And again, that's, you know, a pretty important element to being a racer, is not dwelling too much on your issues or your injuries and just cracking on with the job at hand.
Yeah, and not to draw too many comparisons to football, but sometimes, you know, footballer rested up for 2 weeks with a dead leg or something, and you think, oh my God, like these, especially, you know, racing, the gravity orientated side, there seems to be constantly things going on. An injury, or I suppose something I wanted to talk to you about, and it's something I only realised recently, is I suppose the condition you have with your vision. If you could just explain to the listeners about your eyesight and how it affects your riding, I think that'd be really interesting.
Yeah, yeah. So I've got a really bad lazy eye in my right eye. So it's from birth. It's basically the muscle between the eye and the brain isn't connected. So my right eye is just fully out of focus. Like, you know, I can, if I close my left eye, I can see the general outlines of things in front of me, but not much at all, to be honest. So my left eye is doing pretty much most of the work. Like, when I go get my eyes tested, I'm 20 on my left and zero on my right. Like, I can't even come close to reading the top letter on that eye test. So, like, it's since birth, so, like, it's all I know. So I'm kind of used to it. It's, I guess a big thing would be that I've less peripheral vision on my right side because I'm pretty much just looking at my left eye. So, you know, in terms of riding, it doesn't cause too many issues. I guess one thing it maybe hurts me with a little bit is right-handers, because I don't have so much peripheral vision on that side. My brain's a bit more reluctant to let my body fall towards the right, like to drop into a corner. But, you know, it's something I'm used to. I know no different. So I just enjoy the left-handers a bit more.
Do you have any, you know, in the community, do you know any other riders with impaired vision? Because sometimes you hear about it a bit, but just, how do you feel? I mean, obviously you don't need different, but does it affect, you know, depth perception and things like that? It must be, when you're going that fast as well, riding trails blind, you know, like not knowing what's coming up. It's crazy.
It's funny you say, do I know anyone else? Because, so my mom is a twin, and her twin has two sons who both race motocross, and one of them, so he'd be my cousin, has the exact same thing, where it's the same LA, same kind of level of problem and that. And he races motocross to a good level. And we always joke that if we get a bit of mud in our good eye, then that's it, you know, job done. So I always have to be like at a muddy race where I'm pretty careful to try keep my goggles good, because if I'm going to get mud in my left eye, I'm as good as gone. And in terms of depth perception, it's a funny one. I was chatting to my coach a bit about this, and I won't get too scientific because I'll probably get it wrong, but he was saying how it's different parts of the brain that judge whether you're traveling across ground or if something's traveling towards you, it's a different kind of system, I guess. So for me, traveling across ground and judging that depth perception actually isn't a problem. But if you start playing table tennis with me, I am absolutely terrible and I'll just be swinging at the air.
Wow.
Because I struggle to judge the ball moving towards me. Which is quite funny. I always just thought I was crap at table tennis. And then he explained this to me and I was like, right, I actually have an excuse.
That's going to come out at the famous Callahan Table Tennis Christmas Championship.
Yeah. Yeah.
Another thing I just wanted to briefly talk to you about is you mentioned, you know, competing on 25-minute stages in somewhere like Chile. Coming from the comparatively smaller hills, how the hell do you train for something like that? Is it a lot of time away? Is it, you know, just technical skills you practice and also high intensity? But going to Chile to race, how, you know, what's your preparation?
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard to get that kind of preparation. One way to do it is motocross. You know, it's pretty easy on a easy in some ways, not for your arms maybe, but to go out the motocross track and do 20, 25 minute motos, you know, that helps a lot. But I think the difference is, like in Ireland, our stages are 3, 4, 5 minutes, but they're so intense. Like for those few minutes, you get absolutely no break. You're pedaling, you're pumping, braking, you know, you're always doing something. So it's a much higher intensity. So then when you get to those longer stages, it's almost like you're toning things back. So you're used to riding at 100% at home and then you're like, right, I can ride this at 90% and that'll get me the, you know, the full length pretty good. And again, a lot of the time with those types of stages, I usually try break it down into like stages within the stages. You know, it's never 25 minutes, balls to the wall, flat out. It'll usually be a section and then there might be a easy flowy bit or a climb or something, and you can kind of use them to break a stage in your head into blocks, and then you can pace those different blocks differently, you know, sections where maybe it's a bit risky so you tone it back a bit, or sections where it's fine so you can really let it on, or sections where maybe you're coming into a physical bit or just after a physical bit so you want to recover. And you know, I think the bigger thing is, you know, the tactics of it. I think long stages like that, a lot of the time it comes back to the tactics. And I think a great example of that I saw was in Chile last time when we had that crazy long stage that was like 25 minutes and I had a bit of mechanical, so I couldn't ride to my full potential. So Adrian Daly caught me and he came past me on a downhill and I was like, oh my God, he is on the absolute ragged edge. Like, it was insane. And then we got to a pedaling section and I just rode past him again. Because like he came past me on the downhill, so I like tried my best to hang on to him. And then we got to a flat pedally section and I just rode past him and I was like, man, he's cruising, like what's going on? And then we get to the next downhill and he just comes hauling past me again. And I was like, whoa, this is so interesting. And then he crashed ahead of me, so I came around the corner, he was on the ground, I passed him, I crashed, he passed me. We actually ended up passing each other loads of times on this stage. But I got to the, then after that I was just like, wow, like he had such a different approach to what I was planning to race the stage with, and he ended up third or second or third on that stage. Like, it was a really good result, and I was just like, he never actually put himself in that red zone. So yeah, it was really, really interesting to see that firsthand, because yeah, there's so many different ways of racing stages like that. And again, it comes back to that point of so many different things happen yet the times end up so close. So yeah, it's hell of a tangent there I've gone off on, but yeah, you know, you can still, the training we do here in Ireland is, although it's so different, it translates over pretty well as well. And I think it's probably easier for us to go from that short intense stuff to the longer stuff than it is to go the other way if you were used to only doing long stuff. And you know, I think that was one of the big advantages for me in Ireland, was I was used to racing that kind of stage that's so intense and so flat out start to finish.
So in a couple of weeks, I suppose, maybe neatly to prepare you for your season, I believe you'll be at the Andes Pacifico in Chile. I suppose trips like that are absolutely crucial if you do want to train, you know, over the European winter. Do you normally get away during the summer? Well, Southern Hemisphere summer?
Yeah, I do. Well, it depends. Like, we've kind of been following a system of the races switching between 1 year being Australia, New Zealand, and then the next being South America. So the years we're in, starting our season in New Zealand, I'll go out a few weeks early and, you know, make it like any excuse to go to New Zealand, really. You know, it's such a rad place, as you know. I'd go out a few weeks early and enjoy that. And then last year we spent a lot of time in Finale de Gur for the off season, which was really cool. And then this year, I've always wanted to do the Andes Pacifico, and everyone always tells me how great it is. So this year I heard that they're going to a new venue. It's going to be totally new stages. So I was like, right, I'm doing it. You know, because that's a clean slate. Like, I raced Trans-Provence before, and it was the fifth year of a pretty similar route. So it was kind of like every day people kind of knew the stages and stuff. So it was a bit like, it doesn't feel, you know, totally blind. Whereas this one should be like that.
Even if you bring it back to what you said about Adrian Daly, just knowing where the climbs are or the traverses are in a stage can be a huge advantage.
Yeah.
Not even knowing where the snaggy routes are.
Exactly. Yeah. Especially a race like that, you know, you really don't know what you're getting in those multi-day stage races. Like, you could have a 2-3 minute climb in a stage, and from what you can see as you're riding it, it might look like 20 seconds. So you go, you know, all out, and you'll pretty quickly regret that. So, yeah, I'm really, really looking forward to it. Like, I'm sure it's going to be a crazy week. I can't wait.
Because Rich from GMBN is racing the Andes Pacifico. I'm going over as part of the contingent. I think he's anticipating me giving him, like, peeled grapes and sliced oranges and, you know, cleaning his bike. But it'd be certainly cool to hang out, maybe do something while we're there.
Awesome.
Thank you very much for coming on the podcast. It's been absolutely great having you on. And very exciting about the big news. Best of luck with the new team.
No, thanks for having me on. Always good to chat bikes. And I'll see you again soon, I'm sure.
Yeah, cheers for that, mate.
Sweet. Thank you very much.